So I've been asked by several of the monks and laity around what my experience was like living in Thailand, just having recently returned. And so I thought I'd just talk a little bit about that with some Dhamma themes mixed in. It's very lovely that Ajahn Jayasaro is about to join us, who is a very senior monk in our tradition, I think just about 5 years junior to Lumbur Pasno. And they spent a lot of time together in Thailand, and in fact traded off positions sometimes when Lumbur would leave Wat Phananachat. When he was the abbot, then Ajahn Jayasaro would come in, and then, or he would stay at one of the branch monasteries and help with that. So he was sort of, as I understand it, Lumbur's right-hand man for some of the time that they lived together in Thailand, and a good friend. So it's lovely that during the COVID time, he hadn't come here so much. So I think this will be his second visit since COVID. Is that correct? Oh, this is the first one. Okay, wow. 18, wow. All right, okay. So 6 years. And the reason I mentioned Ajahn Jayasaro is I was fortunate to spend some time with him as well. And when I was in Thailand, and he's just a very special monk, quite a unique monk in that he ended up staying in Thailand, I think since he was about 18 or 19, when he was a Pakhao. And then some early point at that time in his life. In fact, there's a recording of him when he was Anagarkha, a Pakhao, and he was just interviewed by I think it was a BBC interview thing where a man would go around and he'd go to different situations where people were, I think it was mostly religious, and interview people. So we got to see him as a Pakhao when he was about 18 or 19. Anyway, one of the things that's very special about Ajahn Jayasaro, and also I should mention that when Lumbur Pasno left Thailand, it was very much through Ajahn Jayasaro's help. He ended up agreeing to stay at Wat Phananachat, although officially he never took on the title of abbot. Lumbur continued to hold on to that, or he didn't hold on to it. He was Ajahn Jayasaro. Actually, I think that's just what was understood as what would be kind of help the situation, and Ajahn Jayasaro was the senior monk, but he really was the abbot Lumbur when Lumbur came over here to America and became the co-abbot here. So I'm happy for everyone that they can meet Ajahn Jayasaro. He's his Thai is incredibly, it's just amazing. People say he speaks better Thai than most Thais, and then just his sort of depth of knowledge and particular take on Dhamma, very beautiful to listen to, his talks, that'll be nice. But he, in a way, he's sort of a symbol similar to Lumbur, and for me, similar to Ajahn Yanako, who spent, a lot of time in Thailand. I think Lumbur was in Thailand for 24 years as a monk, and that's quite a... After visiting Thailand, spending some time in there during the cold season, I realized I don't know if I'm gonna, if it's sort of for me to go and live in Thailand again. It was I tend to be quite heat aversive, and so just knowing that monks like Lumbur and Ajahn Jayasaro and Ajahn Yanako just was asked, and I think it'd been 7 years that he spent himself in Thailand, and quite amazing. So part of my trip and part of what it was like being there was really about sort of a bit of a pilgrimage around the monasteries that Lumbur has spent a lot of time managing, and the two branch monasteries that he actually established. And I wasn't aware of exactly how instrumental Lumbur was until I went to those two branch monasteries, Pujumgum and Daudum. These were the branch monasteries of Wat Phananachat, which is the international forest monastery in Thailand, and where Lumbur was the abbot for 14 years. And so I got to stay in at Wat Nanachat for a month, and Lumpur left me there. It wasn't like a surprise. He didn't just say, "You're staying here." But I was invited to stay by Ajahn Siripanyo. And at the time when he invited me to stay, I actually really didn't want to go. Ajahn Yanako had actually offered me to be on a solitary retreat here at Abhayagiri during the winter retreat. And so I was like, no, I don't want to give that up. But there was something in me that said, yeah, this is the right time. It's a good time to go. And I have not, like other monks here, spent time in Thailand as a monk. So it was a little taste, being there 4.5 months. And there were a lot of stories so many stories over the years that I've heard. And then also kind of feeling, yeah, a little bit in awe, just sort of that specialness again that Lumpur and Ajahn Yanako, and of course Ajahn Sek, who has lived most of his life in Thailand, Ajahn Gai, these monks were, this is the sort of the homeland of our tradition. And how much of these senior monks who I very much look up to, this is what is really informing in a lot of ways how we behave in our worldview. Not just the Buddha's teachings and the suttas, but the very lived experience of where our tradition comes from. So this was quite a special opportunity for me, and in a way I was also taken under the wing of Ajahn Siripanyo, who's a monk who's he's the lived at one of these branch monasteries for the last 17 years as a senior monk there. So also a very special monk and someone who I've very much admired throughout my life as a monk, just having some times that I've been in contact with him. He stayed here at Abhayagiri for a Vasa, so I think maybe four months or so. One of the things that I guess one of the Dhamma themes that came up for me a lot in Thailand was being associated with what one doesn't want. And there was a lot of things that I got used to that were different for me in Thailand. But what was interestingly, most interesting was just like being a monk there. It just didn't seem like there was a huge change in that effect. The sense of being a monk was very normal, how we wore our robes, how we regarded other monks and lived with other monks, how we ate food. I had a bit of a more specialized experience with alms round, so that was that again, historically, hearing a lot about Bung Wai, this village that is right outside of this monastery where Lumpur was the abbot for so many years, and just going on alms round and seeing it in a film and actually being there and walking barefoot. And yeah, it was very special for me. But again, the sense of like the decorum of being a monk, how it was to really behave, there wasn't such a big change there. Few things in the West have been slightly changed in terms of the landscape of the monastery works with the monks and the lay people and guests and how that is. And also, of course, one of the main differences is that the city of Bung Wai, as well as Ubon, the larger city, a little bit further away, is really what a place that supports, these places support the monastery, but they're also like visited upon by these people. It's really like this is their monastery for many people in Ubon, and especially Bung Wai. This is kind of their local monastery. And so that was a bit of a qualitative difference. It's a large number of people rather than maybe just a few who live locally. One of the things, though, that I was getting used to, and I've talked to the monks already about this, was sort of just a sense of discomfort and just getting used to the things that were a little bit different for me. And the weather was quite different for me to deal with. So that was just, just being in places where I was just sweating most of the time. And again, there was that association with, I don't like this, there was just an air conditioning unit nearby. But then the longer that I lived with this, the more it just became very normal for me. There weren't you know, there wasn't so much suffering unless I really created that suffering in my own mind, which many of us can relate to. And of course, there was the interesting aspect that, like, there's times at Abhaya Giri where it's very uncomfortable here. It gets extremely hot and like almost burning heat. And yet, you know, the mind can suffer around that, or there can just be times where it's just one, let's go. It's not a problem. And we get used to more basic standards. And we see that it's just, it's really the problem is within our own minds when we're yearning for something different. And so one of these other things that most of the monks can understand when I talk to them about were some of the more unique features, just the bugs and insect life. There are these things called dukes. In Thailand, they're these like about 14-inch long lizards. And I had about 9 of them living in the kuti I was in at Nanachat. And at night they would, you know, occasionally, I found out, you know, first there was this, you know, it was the middle of the night and I wake up and it's just, duke, duke, duke. And then I'm, you know, there was a kind of panic and what's going on. I didn't really know what that was at first. And then what was funny is the end of this whole thing, because they're really going, as they end with a, duke, and then stops. So I thought, oh, I can't live with this. This is crazy. Is this going to be every hour? And there's like several of them up there, and they're kind of scary, actually. They have these big heads snapping at insects. I didn't know if they were going to come in the kuti from the roof and like snap at me. I didn't know what was going to happen. Nothing happened. It was fine. And that I remember at Tisaran Monastery, I was put in a kuti when I first got there in my 6th vasa, I think, and there was this bird called a whippoorwill. And I don't know how many of you have ever heard this bird, but it's the loudest thing I've ever experienced in my life. And it was about 15 feet from my kuti. It was a fence, and it would just sit on the fence. I think, Lumpur, you know the whippoorwill. And yeah, I mean, if you ever want to really hear something, because I don't think a computer hearing it over audio would really do it justice, because the volume can't go high enough to actually represent how loud it was. And this thing went on a lot longer than the duke and every night. So I'm, you know, at a certain point, I'm like, you know, God, this thing's got to stop. But eventually, again, it just stops being a problem. The bird goes away or it dies or something. I mean, who knows what happens. I didn't kill it, by the way. There are rules prohibiting us from doing such a thing. But yeah, anyways, it turned out with the dukes is it was pretty rare that they actually did their midnight shouting. And then all of a sudden they became kind of lovable. They wouldn't be if they were doing this every night, but they're okay. And I just didn't like their pooping, because they pooped like all just wherever. It was just random, kind of like, well, it was in the line of where they kind of were in the roof. And I would kind of talk to them sometimes and ask them to, you know, rethink this a little bit. You know, just kind of, can't you poop somewhere else? Because it was right where I walked. But then it just, you know, of course, I didn't really expect anything was going to come of that. And so I just swept it away and tried to get used to that. But then there were the geckos, and the geckos actually came into the kuti. And they had a much sweeter kind of, they would laugh. So it was like, and then they would poop everywhere in the kuti. And that was hard to deal with. And I'll explain to you why later when I get to my experience at Dowdham. But yeah, so that was whatever. Just cleaning up these things, and it became less a problem, less of a burden. It almost was a little bit of fun, because there's a sense of, right, here they are again. They pooped here, sort of like a welcoming gift or something. I know that they're there. They feel comfortable enough around me to poop in and around the kuti. So I felt like, okay, you guys, you're all right with me. We're all right with each other. Yeah, and just getting used to these incredible insects, the loudest cicadas, and then the humans. Oh my gosh, I didn't realize the people would talk about music being played and around the monastery. Oh, how, you know, how bad can it be? And it honestly wasn't so bad, but it was just like I would get up at night because I couldn't sleep. I would usually get up every hour and a half. Something weird about being in Thailand, and the music was there. This is, you know, it's techno music in the distance. So there was, yeah, there was these things that I could get upset about, but eventually it just became like, yeah, this is sort of not a problem. You know, how to not make a problem out of these things that, like, you know, I could make a stance like, all these people know that there's a monastery here. I mean, they know it, you know, and how could they play music? How could they have fun, you know, or want to have fun when they know that we're monks meditating here? And it was, you know, of course, it's just, this is just normal life. You know, this is, there's probably a sense of like, well, in Thailand in general, there's just a much more of a sense of noise tolerance and people don't care so much. So I was happy to sort of join that eventually and allow that aversion to fade. But it, you know, it did take a while to get used to it. And then, as Ajahn Jayasaro noted, like if you ever hear a chainsaw for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden it stops, there is that recognition of peace. Like, oh, wow, that's quite different. I didn't even know that was affecting me. But the time in Thailand, these were the kind of things that I think are helpful to really experience, to understand like how we can be around aversive qualities, whether it's the weather or insects or different beings. I had one of the things that was a problem for me was the birds. So I would hear these birds and say, oh, which one's that? And so I'd take an interest in it, and then I would get caught into this, and I think I'm spending a little too much time kind of being interested in these birds and, you know, what they are, and or being, you know, so then there can be desire around something. You know, you hear something that is pleasant for you, and so for me it was, you know, these birds, and what made it that the birds were more, you know, pleasant and the insects or the lizards weren't. It's just a very arbitrary experience. I never quite would say that about the weather. Just the amount of heat was could be quite unpleasant. But yet, each day it would go by. You know, you'd go through this unpleasantness, and then the mind would just have no choice but to really let go. So yeah, the experiences I had were very much around just, I think, a statement that Ajahn Amaro has. I think he had a cup actually that came here with this statement on it. He said, adaptation, do you remember what it was? Is the key to happiness?
Adaptability.
Yeah. Adaptability, right? Thank you, Ajahn Yanako, is the key to happiness. And no matter what, if we keep that in mind, then there's not really a problem. You know, we don't have to make a problem out of our lives. And so I remember that as I would go from these different monasteries, there was also this another quality that was interesting to watch was, you know, I went to Pujamgom, as I mentioned. This was the branch monastery that was set up before Daudam, if I'm not incorrect. Pujamgom. Around the same time. Yeah. And so that was a very beautiful thing to go and spend time. I just spent 10 days there, and I had met the senior monk there. He's an Israeli monk named Ajahn Sukito. He's been a monk for almost 30 years. And just spending time with him again from when I met him in 2017. And there was that experience again of like, I don't want, because I arrived, and then the next day I was like, oh, I got COVID. And then it was just living in a kuti with, you know, kind of just trying to recover from COVID. And the weather was much more like a Bayagiri here. It was very dry and hot. And that was, you know, it was still like working with that sense of the unpleasantness in the body. And then seeing that there, you know, it just continued to be this source of working with the mind. You know, how does the mind work with that? And of course, there were so many other things that I was seeing that were quite beautiful, and that it was just about kind of not moving my mind into that negativity. You know, the body shouldn't be sick. It shouldn't be like this. I should be healthy, and it's sick isn't normal. What's normal is when I'm healthy. And so these are just these kind of unfortunate aspects of how we can treat adverse experiences without just seeing that adaptability is the key to happiness. And so when we're okay with that, it's okay. Well, you know, this is just a normal thing. COVID has affected so many people on the planet, and I remember that the another monk and I got it at the same time. We were in a van together, and then this other monk who was at the monastery, he was he had some sort of health things. He was a bit hypochondriac, and when I told him I had COVID, he told me I haven't had COVID the entire pandemic, and he it was a very personal thing that I had gotten him sick, so I ended up getting him sick, or the other monk, whatever it was. And just working with that and kind of seeing, then a fire came and went like right up to his kuti. And I would ask him every morning, how are you feeling? And when the fire came right up to his kuti, there are these grass fires that come around Pujamgom that one would need to put out if it gets that close to the kuti. He said, and I said, how are you feeling this morning? He said, you know, I don't really care about COVID anymore. I just don't want my kuti to burn down. nor so when I'm in it. So these things, they just the mind can kind of concoct a problem out of something, and it can really take on that problem with such enormity that it surrounds our whole world. And for those of us who had COVID at one time or whatever, for me it just wasn't a big deal. It was just a very minor experience. The flu that I gave to Lumpur earlier in India was more unpleasant. Sorry, Lumpur, again. But that's, it just goes to show you, I this monk really didn't want to have COVID, and this was really bad, and then all of a sudden there's a fire next to his kuti, and it doesn't, there's no care in the world about this illness anymore. So we can try to see that as an example of just these things that we take on as being a problem, as an imposter. It's not really, really isn't a problem. We just take it on as a problem, and that's not saying that it's not that way for everyone. As we know, COVID actually killed and is still killing people, but not to the rate it did in the beginning. But there can be these problems, and we have to deal with them. We have to adapt to them in one way or another. So it was nice to, it was a very good opportunity to spend time in that monastery, even though I was recovering from COVID. But just to also know that gratitude that I had, Lumpur was instrumental, possibly even in the site that I was at, although Ajñānika would know. I think Ajñānika said he stayed in that kuti that I stayed in, Sota kuti. And so that was another thing that I got to feel, was especially at Pujamgom, because both Lumpur and Ajñānika had their hands in there. Ajñānika was the senior monk there for 2 years, I believe, and had built the storage office workshop building, which is a big building. It was a nice sized building next to the kitchen, and the a couple of the lay people were very instrumental in helping the monastery function. One of the cooks was, they all knew Ajñānika. And then knowing that Lumpur Pasano, the Dhamma hall, the sala that was, fairly rudimentary, but quite appropriate for the setup there and very easy to maintain, was set up by Lumpur Pasano. And there's a lot of gratitude that arose out of being there. And knowing that there, this history was kind of continued forward into Abhayagiri. And I was very much touched by that. That was a part of my experience I wasn't expecting so much. And from there, after a couple of other adventures, I went on to Dauda Monastery, which is a monastery that Lumpur set up as through a mining concession. A woman had invited Lumpur to see if a monastery could be set up there in a way. and very different, you know, monastery that I've ever experienced. Sort of the monks all live on mostly, there's a couple of kutis in the forest, or maybe four or five actually, in this upper forest about 40 minutes walk away. Depending on how you walk, you could do it in 15, but I pretty badly injured myself doing that. But there's 1,000 steps in about 15 minutes. And anyway, there's an inner forest, an area, outer forest. There's this place, and the monks live up there on these what are called diings. So they're just these very basic bamboo platforms. Many of the several of the monks here have lived there and spent time there, survived. They didn't get attacked by a tiger, although Ajahn Sudhiro's missing did run into a large black panther. And he did avoid. He did think it was going to attack him, but didn't happen. Anyway, the experience there was just more, it's hard to describe, but it was living in a jungle, and there really are wild animals around, and the abbot there, as I mentioned, Ajahn Siripanyo, has been there 17 years, and he doesn't sort of pull his punches around practice. Like, he really encourages the monks to live in a very minimal way, just on these diings. They're a platform that's raised up about 3 feet above the ground, and then there's just a tarp over them, a large tarp, and then under that, for insects, there's an umbrella that has a mosquito net draped over it, and so also it protects you against tigers and other wild animals. So you think this thin screen of mosquito. At least that's what monks kind of feel when they're under it and they're freaked out by some noise they hear. But it's not going to protect you against a tiger. So that's the rudimentary way that the monks are living. And so they'll live on these diings. And Ajahn Siripanyo would encourage them, don't use this mosquito net at all, except when there are mosquitoes out, and just sleep out in the open, sit out in the open, walk late at night, with some candles, and it was just an incredible way to live. I was actually in a kuti in the lower area, so I didn't have quite that same experience. But again, you know, just that sort of sense of working with discomfort. I mentioned that one of the things that occurred was there was there were these dukes again, or not the dukes, the geckos in my kuti, and so. Yeah, I don't know why this just became a continual thing for me, but or not letting go, but they would poop in different places. And finally, when I woke up one night and I said, "What is that smell?" and I woke up, and sure enough, they'd poop right where my head was. Luckily, not on my face, but there might have been some contact there. And I just, why can't you stop? But then the one that was living in there started being more respectful and pooping over by the door, and I thanked him or her for that. And then it happened again over by my head, and I thought we had an agreement here, but these, again, they're just like, they were kind of mild things. You talk about thinking about, like, well, there's actually tigers around, so they're pretty rare, but there are, what aren't rare are like more forest cats and different animals and elephants. And surely there is a sense of danger. There is king cobras around, and one does feel that sense of fear a little bit more walking out in the middle of the night or walking out when it gets dark. And the forest is surrounding you. There's the nearest person is not too far away. It could be 5 minutes away, but for some of the monks it could be 10 minutes, 20 minutes, even 30 or 40 minutes away. And if something were to happen, there's a real chance one could die. So you're really living in the raw experience of that jungle. And I think for me in that experience as well, I was just taught to really also live with just being seen as meat for beings, just like just being available, again, adapting to just other animals eating me. Because the amount of insects that I would wake up with just these odd bites all over my body. And even one hasn't healed. It's been about 3 months, 3-4 months, and just rather than fighting that experience, just allowing that, like, well, this is how it is. I'm not it's really not that bad. There's an itch here, an itch there. But seeing the dukkha that came out of that, that experience of not, you know, really not wanting, wanting this. And so over and over again, my experience in Thailand was around letting go, trying to work with adverse conditions, and seeing how helpful it was to do that, to work on that sense of relinquishing and letting go, and trying to adapt as well I could. I think that I was quite spoiled, because it wasn't until the last 4 days that I left that I really knew what Thai heat was, when it was over 100 degrees with felt like it was like 10,000% humidity and almost felt hard to breathe. And yet again, it was just saying, like, can I just focus on my breath? Can I allow that sense of mindfulness and clear awareness of my own experience guide me, rather than wanting a different condition, wanting something to be quite different than the way it was? And also, I would say that sense of knowing that, you know, other monks here, like Thon Rokito, Thon Sudiko, Ajahn Gai, Ajahn Sik, I mean, the list just goes on of monks who have lived in Thailand, and monks like Lumpur, Ajahn Sik, it's just decades. And there was that, like, almost supreme happiness, knowing that adaptability took place, and it provided the space for what I would understand or assume was a lot of wisdom to arise. And I've always admired having not only Lumpur, but Ajahn Yanako as the abbot, who spent, you know, a significant part of his life as a monk in Thailand, and really learned a lot of skills there that helped shape his ability to be the abbot. And so, I think overall there was just an enormous amount of appreciation for my experience, and I don't think I would have had it any differently, except I guess air conditioning would have been, you know, more air conditioning. I did have air conditioning a few times, some of the time. So, that I can hold that in my mind from now on. Like, okay, I was in Thailand for some time as a monk. There were some times where I was living a pretty rudimentary experience, and I had some difficulties. I had things come up in my mind that I wasn't able to let go of, stories, and yet the Dhamma was what was that saving grace, was that practice with really understanding the Buddha's teachings, really understanding what it was to be present and clear and mindful. And I can say that those times when I was practicing with, you know, for example, Anapanasati, it was just such a beautiful experience to drop so much of the aversion or the inability to adapt or the wishing for different conditions, and just be with the breath, just be with the experience of what we can learn when we're able to drop those things and really understand mindfulness and sati sambhajanya. I just want to express my gratitude for the community allowing me to go, and for so much history to have been passed from the monks who are currently here, having lived in Thailand, and for that relationship with the tradition there, really informing us in so many ways that has an incredible benefit. And also for, you know, now we're quite blessed to have two Thai monks here, and that's something not to take for granted, that it's quite a helpful opportunity for us. So these are just some ramblings about my experience, and thank you for listening.